putting a note of urgency into his voice. "Governor!" Inspector Harry Harrison came across to Wilkinson's position. A tall man, he had been running his hands through his thinning hair, and now he looked more distraught than he was. He said, "Everything under control, Sergeant?" "I think I caught a mayday from Obadiah, Gov." Harrison snapped, "What do you mean, think?" Wilkinson had not made Sergeant by admitting his mistakes. He said, "Distorted message, sir." Harrison picked up the mic. "Obadiah controlled a mobile. Do you read? Over." He waited, then repeated the message. There was no reply. He said to Wilkinson, "A distorted message, then they go off the air. We've got to treat it as a hijack. That's all I need." He had the air of a man to whom fate has been not merely unjust, but possibly vindictive. Wilkinson said, "I didn't get a location." They both turned to look at the giant map of London on the wall. Wilkinson said, "They took the river route. Last time they checked in was at Aldgate. Traffic's normal, so they must be somewhere like, say, Dagenham." "Great," Harrison said sarcastically. He thought for a moment. "Put out an all-cars alert, then detach 3 from East London patrols and send them on a search. Alert Essex, and make sure those idle sods know how much bloody money's in that van. All right, on your bike." Wilkinson began to make the calls. Harrison stood behind him for a few moments, deep in thought. "We should get a call before too long. Somebody must have seen it happen," he muttered. He thought a bit more. "But then if Chummy's clever enough to knock the radio out before the boys can call in, he's clever enough to do the job somewhere quiet." There was a longer pause. Finally, Harrison said, "Personally, I don't think we stand a sodding chance." It was going like a dream, Jacko thought. The currency van had been hoisted over the wall and gently set down beside the cutting gear. The 4 police motorcycles had been tossed aboard the transporter, which had then reversed into the yard. The riders now lay in a neat line, each of them handcuffed, hand and foot, and the yard gates were shut. 2 of the boys, wearing goggles over their stocking masks, made a man-sized hole in the side of the currency van, while another plain blue van was backed up. A large rectangle of steel fell away, and a uniformed guard jumped out with his hands above his head. Jesse handcuffed him and made him lie down beside the police escort. The cutting gear was wheeled away rapidly, and 2 more men got into the currency van and began to pass the chests out. They were put straight into the second van. Jacko cast an eye over the prisoners. They'd all been bashed about a bit, but not seriously. All were conscious. Jacko was perspiring under the mask, but he dare not take it off. There was a shout from the cabin of the crane, where one of the boys was keeping watch. Jacko looked up. At the same time, he heard the sound of a siren. He looked around. It couldn't be true. The whole idea was that they should knock the guards out before they had time to radio for help. He cursed. The men were looking to him for guidance. The transporter had backed behind a pile of tyres, so the white motorcycles could not be seen. The 2 vans and the crane looked innocent enough. Jacko shouted, "Everybody get under cover!" Then he remembered the prisoners. No time to drag them out of the way. His eye lit upon a tarpaulin. He pulled it over the 5 bodies, then dived behind a skip. The siren came nearer. The car was travelling very fast. He heard the squeal of tyres as it swung under the railway arch, then the scream of the engine as the car touched 70 in 3rd before changing up. The sound got louder. Then suddenly the pitch of the siren dropped, and the noise began to recede. Jacko breathed a sigh of relief, then heard the second siren. He yelled, "Stay down!" The second car passed, and he heard a third. There was the same squeal under the arch, the same third gear burst after the corner, but this time the car slowed outside the gate. Everything seemed very quiet. Jacko's face was unbearably hot under the nylon. He felt he was going to suffocate. He heard a sound like policeman's boots scraping on the gate. One of them must be climbing up to have a look over. Suddenly Jacko remembered that there were 2 more guards in the cab of the van. He hoped to Christ they didn't come round just now. What's the copper up to? He hadn't climbed right over, but he hadn't fallen back either. If they came in for a good look, it'd all be up. "No, don't panic," he thought. 10 of us can see to a car full of woolies. But it'd take time. And they might have left one in the car who could radio for reinforcements. Jacko could almost feel all that money slipping through his fingers. He wanted to risk a peep around the side of the skip, but he told himself there was no point. He would know when they left by the sound of the car. What were they doing? He looked again at the currency van. Jesus! One of the blokes was moving. Jacko hefted his shotgun. It was going to come to a fight, he whispered. Oh, bollocks. There was a noise from the van, a hoarse yell. Jacko scrambled to his feet and stepped around the skip with his gun ready. There was nobody there. Then he heard the car pull away with a screech of tyres. Its siren started up again and faded into the distance. Deaf Willie emerged from behind the rusty shell of a Mercedes taxi. Together they went toward the van. Willie said, "Jolly good fun, ain't it?" "Yes," Jacko said sourly. "Better than watching a bloody television." They looked inside the van. The driver was groaning, but he didn't look badly hurt.
"Out you come, Grandad," Jacko said through the broken window. "Tea break's over."
The voice had a calming effect on Ron Biggins. Until then, he'd been dazed and panicky. He didn't seem to be hearing properly. There was a pain in his head. And when he put his hand up to his face, he touched something sticky. The sight of a man in a stocking mask was curiously bracing. It was all very clear. An extremely efficient raid. In fact, Ron was somewhat awed by the smoothness of the operation. They'd known the route and the timing of the currency van's trip. He began to feel angry. No doubt a percentage of the haul would find its way into the secret bank account of a corrupt detective. Like most police and security workers, he hated bent coppers even more than villains. The man who'd called him Grandad opened the door, reaching through the shattered glass of the side window to operate the internal lock. Ron got out. The movement hurt him. The man was young. Ron could distinguish long hair underneath the stocking. He wore jeans and carried his shotgun. He gave Ron a contemptuous push and said, "Hands out, neatly together, Pop. You can go to hospital in a minute." The pain in Ron's head seemed to grow with his anger. He fought down an urge to kick out at something and made himself remember how he was supposed to behave during a raid. "Don't resist. Cooperate with them. Give them the money. We're insured for it. Your own life is more valuable to us. Don't be a hero." He began to breathe hard. In his concussed mind, he confused the young man holding the shotgun with the corrupt detective and with Lou Furley panting and groaning on top of innocent virginal Judy in some verminous bed at a dingy studio apartment. And suddenly he realized that it was this man who had messed up his, Ron's, life, and that maybe a hero was what he needed to be to win back the respect of his only child, and that no goods like this corrupt detective wearing a stocking mask in bed with Judy and carrying a shotgun was the kind who always messed it up for good people like Ron Biggins. So he took two steps forward and punched the astonished young man's nose, and the man stumbled and pulled both triggers of his gun, shooting not Ron, but another masked man beside him, who screamed blood and fell down. And Ron stared, horrified at the blood, until the first man hit him over the head very hard with the metal barrel of the gun, and Ron passed out again. Jacko knelt beside Deaf Willie and pulled the shreds of stocking away from the older man's face. Willie's face was a dreadful mess, and Jacko went pale. Jacko and his like usually inflicted wounds upon their victims and one another with blunt instruments. Consequently, Jacko had never seen gunshot wounds before. And since in-house training in first aid was not one of the perks in Tony Cox's management training scheme, Jacko didn't really know what to do. But he was capable of quick thinking. He looked up. The others were standing around staring. Jacko yelled, "Get on with it, you dozy bastards!" They jumped. He bent closer to Willie and said, "Can you hear me, mate?" Willie's face twisted, but he was unable to speak. Jesse knelt on Willie's other side. "We've got to get him to hospital," he said. Jacko was ahead of him. "I need a hot car," he said. He pointed to a blue Volvo parked nearby. "Whose is that?" "Belongs to the owner of the yard," Jesse said. "Perfect. Help me get Willie in there." Jacko took his shoulders and Jesse's legs. They carried him to the car, whimpering, and put him on the back seat. The keys were in the ignition. One of the men called from the currency truck. "Hold on, Jacko!" Jacko would have struck the man for using his name, but he was preoccupied. He said to Jesse, "Now where are you going?"
"Yes, but you're supposed to come with me."
"Never mind. I'll get Willie to hospital somehow and meet you at the farm. Tell Tony what happened now. Drive slow. Don't shoot the lights. Pull up at zebra crossings. Do it like it was a bleeding driving test, okay?"
"Yes," Jesse said.
He ran back to the getaway van and tested the rear doors. They were locked. He stripped the brown paper off the license plates. Its purpose had been to stop the guards getting the number. Tony Cox thought of everything and got behind the wheel. Jacko started the Volvo. Someone opened the yard gate. The rest of the men were already getting into their own cars and peeling off their gloves and masks. Jesse pulled out in the van and turned right. Jacko followed him out and went the opposite way. As he accelerated down the street, he glanced at his watch. 10:27. The whole thing had taken 11 minutes. Tony was right. He'd said they would be away and clear in the time it takes a squad car to get from Vine Street Nick to the Isle of Dogs. It had been a beautiful job, except for poor deaf Willie. Jacko hoped he'd live to spend his share. He was approaching the hospital. He'd figured out the way he'd play it, but he needed Willie to be out of sight. He said, "Will, can you get on the floor?" There was no response. Jacko glanced back. Willie's eyes were such a mess that words like open and shut no longer applied, but the poor sod must be unconscious. Jacko reached behind and pulled the body off the seat onto the floor. It fell with a painful bump. He steered into the hospital grounds and parked in the car park. He got out of the car and followed signs for casualty. Just inside the entrance, he found a payphone. He opened the directory and found the number of the hospital. He dialed, thumbed a coin into the slot and asked for casualty. A phone on a desk near where he stood buzzed twice, and the sister picked it up. She said, "One moment, please," and laid the receiver on the desk. She was a plump woman in her 40s, wearing a crisply starched uniform and had a harassed air. She wrote a few words in a book, then picked the phone up again. "Casualty, can I help you?" Jacko spoke quietly, watching the sister's face. "There's a man with shotgun wounds in the back of a blue Volvo car in your car park." The portly nurse paled. "You mean here?" Jacko was angry. "Yes, you doze your cow in your own hospital. Now get off your bum and go and get him." He was tempted to slam the phone down, but he stopped himself and pressed the cradle instead. If he could see the sister, then she could see him. He held the dead phone to his ear while she put hers down, got to her feet, summoned a nurse, and went out into the car park. Jacko went farther into the hospital and left by another exit. He looked across from the main gate and saw a stretcher being carried across the car park. He'd done all he could now for Willie. Now he needed another car. Chapter 15. Felix Lasky liked the office of Nathaniel Fett. It was a comfortable room with unobtrusive decor, a good place in which to do business. It had none of the gimmicks Lasky used in his own office to give him advantage, like a desk by the window so that his own face was in shadow, or the low, unsteady visitors' chairs, or the priceless bone china coffee cups, which people were terrified of dropping. Fett's office had the atmosphere of a club for company chairmen. No doubt it was deliberate. Lasky noticed two things as he shook Fett's long, narrow hand. First, that there was a large, apparently little-used desk, and second, that Fett wore a club tie. The tie was a curious choice for a Jew, he reflected. Then, on second thoughts, he decided it was not curious at all. Fett wore it for the same reason Lasky wore a beautifully tailored Savile Row pinstriped suit. That's a badge which said, "I, too, am an Englishman." So Lasky thought. Even after six generations of banking, Fett Nathaniel is still a little insecure. It was a piece of information which could be used. Fett said, "Sit down, Lasky. Would you like coffee?"
I drink coffee all day. It's bad for the heart, no thank you. A drink?
Lasky shook his head. Refusing hospitality was one of his ways of putting a host at a disadvantage. He said,
I knew your father quite well until he retired. His death was a loss. This is said of so many people, but in his case it is true.
Thank you.
Fett sat back in a club chair opposite Lasky and crossed his legs. His eyes were inscrutable behind the thick glasses.
It was 10 years ago, he added.
So long. He was much older than I, of course, but he knew that, like his ancestors, I came from Warsaw.
Fett nodded. The first Nathaniel Fett crossed Europe with a bag of gold and a donkey.
I did the same journey on a stolen Nazi motorcycle and a suitcase full of worthless Reichsmarks.
Yet your rise was so much more meteoric.
It was a put-down, Lasky realized. Fett was saying, we may be jumped-up Polish Jews, but we're not half as jumped-up as you. The stockbroker was Lasky's match at this game, and with those spectacles to hide his expression, he did not need the light behind him. Lasky smiled. You're like your father. One never knew what he was thinking.
You haven't yet given me anything to think about.
Ah.
So the small talk is over, Lasky thought.
I'm sorry my phone call was a little mysterious. It was good of you to see me at short notice.
You said you had a 7-figure proposal to put to one of my clients. How could I not see you? Would you like a cigar?
Fett got up and proffered a box from a side table.
Lasky said, thank you. He lingered a little too long over his choice. Then, as his hand descended to take a cigar, he said,
I want to buy Hamilton Holdings from Derek Hamilton.
The timing was perfect, but Fett showed no flicker of surprise. Lasky had hoped he might drop the box, but of course Fett had known Lasky would choose that moment to drop the bombshell, had created the moment for just that purpose. He closed the box and gave Lasky a light without speaking. He sat down again and crossed his legs. Hamilton Holdings for 7 figures.
Exactly £1 million. When a man sells his life's work, he's entitled to a nice round figure.
Oh, I see the psychology of your approach, Fett said lightly. This is not entirely unexpected.
What?
I don't mean we expected you. We expected somebody. The time is ripe.
The bid is substantially more than the value of the shares at current prices.
The margin's about right, Fett said.
Lasky spread his hands, palms upward, in a gesture of appeal. Let's not fence, he said. It's a high offer.
But less than what the shares will be worth if Derek's syndicate gets the oil well.
Which brings me to my only condition. The offer depends upon the deal being done this morning.
Fett looked at his watch. It's almost 11. Do you really think this can be done? Even assuming Derek's interested in 1 hour?
Lasky tapped his briefcase. I have all the necessary documents drawn up.
We could hardly read them.
I also have a letter of intent containing heads of agreement. That will satisfy me.
I should have guessed you'd be prepared. Fett considered for a moment.
Of course, if Derek doesn't get the oil, well, the shares will probably go down a bit. I'm a gambler.
Lasky smiled. Fett continued. In which case, you'll sell off the company's assets and close down the unprofitable branches.
Not at all, Lasky lied. I think it could be profitable in its present form with new top management.
You're probably right.
Well, it's a sensible offer, one that I'm obliged to put to the client. Don't play hard to get. Think of the commission on £1 million.
Yes,
Fat said coldly. I'll ring Derek. He picked up a phone from a coffee table and said, Derek Hamilton, please. Lasky puffed at his cigar and concealed his anxiety. Derek, it's Nathaniel. I've got Felix Lasky with me. He's made an offer. There was a pause. Yes, we did, didn't we? 1 million in round figures. You would... All right, we'll be here. What? Ah, I see. He gave a faintly embarrassed laugh. 10 minutes. He put the phone down. Well, Lasky, he's coming over. Let's read those documents of yours while we're waiting.
Lasky could not resist saying...
He's interested, then. He could be. He said something else, didn't he? Fett gave the embarrassed little laugh again. I suppose there's no harm in telling you. He said that if he gives you the company by midday, he wants the money in his hand by noon. 11 a.m. Chapter 16. Kevin Hart found the address the news desk had given him and parked on a yellow line. His car was a 2-year-old Rover with a V8 engine, for he was a bachelor, and the Evening Post paid Fleet Street salaries, so he was a good deal wealthier than most men aged 22. He knew this, and he took pleasure in it, and he was not old enough to discreetly conceal that pleasure, which was why men like Arthur Cole disliked him. Arthur had been very ratty when he came out of the editor's conference. He had sat behind the news desk, given out a batch of assignments in the usual way, then called Kevin and told him to come around to his side of the desk and sit down, a sure sign that he was about to be given what the reporters called a bollocking. Arthur had surprised him by talking not about the way he had barged into the conference, but about the story. He had asked, what was the voice like? Kevin said, middle-aged man, home county's accent, he was choosing his words, maybe too carefully. He might have been drunk or distressed. That's not the voice I heard this morning, Arthur mused. Mine was younger and cockney. What did yours say? Kevin read from his shorthand. I am Tim Fitzpeterson, and I am being blackmailed by two people called Lasky and Cox. I want you to crucify the bastards when I'm gone. Arthur shook his head in disbelief. That's all? Well, I asked what they were blackmailing him with, and he said, God, you're all the same, and put the phone down on me. Kevin paused, expecting a rebuke. Was that the wrong question? Arthur shrugged. It was, but I can't think of a right one. He picked up the phone and dialed, then handed the receiver to Kevin. Ask him if he's phoned us in the last half hour. Kevin listened for a moment, then cradled the handset. Busy signal. No help. Arthur patted his pockets, looking for cigarettes. You're giving it up, said Kevin, recognizing the symptoms. So I am. Arthur began to chew his nails. You see, the blackmailer's biggest hold over a politician is the threat to go to the newspapers. Therefore, the blackmailers wouldn't ring us and give us the story. That would be throwing away their trump card. By the same token, since the papers are what the victim fears, he wouldn't ring us and say he was being blackmailed. With the air of one who comes to a final conclusion, he finished, That's why I think the whole thing is a hoax. Kevin took it for a dismissal. He stood up. I'll get back to the oil story. No, Arthur said, we've got to check it out. You'd better go round there and knock on his door. Oh, good. But next time you think of interrupting an editor's conference, sit down and count to 100 first. Kevin could not suppress a grin. Sure. But the more he thought about it, the less chance he gave the story of standing up. In the car, he'd tried to recall what he knew of Tim Fitzpeterson.
The man was a low-profile moderate. He had a degree in economics and was reputed to be clever, but he just didn't seem to be sufficiently lively or imaginative a person to provide blackmailers with any raw material. Kevin recalled a photograph of Fitzpeterson and family, a plain wife and three awkward girls on a Spanish beach. The politician and Warden, dreadful pair of khaki shorts. At first sight, the building outside which Kevin now stood seemed an unlikely love nest. It was a dirty, grey 30s block in a Westminster back street. Had it not been so close to Parliament, it would have become a slum by now. As he entered, Kevin saw that the landlords had upgraded the place with an elevator and a hall porter. No doubt they call the flats luxury service apartments. It would be impossible, he thought, to keep a wife and three children here. Or at least a man like Fitzpeterson would think it impossible. It followed that the flat was a pied-à-terre. So Fitzpeterson might have homosexual orgies or pot parties here after all. Stop speculating, he told himself. You'll know in a minute. There was no avoiding the hall porter. His cubbyhole faced the single elevator across a narrow lobby. A cadaverous man with a sunken, white face, he looked for all the world as if he were chained to the desk and never allowed to see the light of day. As Kevin approached, the man put down a book called How to Make Your Second Million and removed his glasses. Kevin pointed to the book. I'd like to know how to make my first. 9, said the porter in a patiently bored voice. Why? You're the 9th person to say that. Oh, sorry. Then you ask why I'm reading it, and I say a resident lent it to me, and you say you'd like to make friends with that resident. Now that we've got all that out of the way, what can I do for you? Kevin knew how to deal with smart Alex. Pander, pander, he told himself aloud. He said, what number's Mr. Fitzpeterson in? I'll ring him for you. The porter reached for the house phone. Just a minute. Kevin brought out his wallet and selected 2 notes. I'd like to surprise him. He winked and laid the money on the counter. The man took the money and said loudly, certainly, sir, as you're his brother. 5C. Thanks. Kevin crossed to the elevator and pressed the button. The conspiratorial wink had done the trick more than the bribe, he guessed. He got into the elevator, pressed the button for the 5th floor, then held the doors open. The porter was reaching for the house phone. Kevin said, a surprise, remember? The porter picked up his book without replying.
This ends side 1 of cassette 3. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 from the same point.
The elevator creaked upward. Kevin felt a familiar physical sensation of anticipation. He always did just before knocking on a door for a story. The feeling was not unpleasant, but it was invariably mixed with a trace of worry that he might not score. The top floor landing was graced with a token square of thin nylon carpet and a few fading watercolours, tasteless but inoffensive. There were 4 flats, each with a bell, a letterbox, and a peephole. Kevin found 5C, took a deep breath, and rang the bell. There was no answer. After a while, he rang again, then put his ear to the door to listen. He could hear nothing. The tension drained out of him, leaving him a little depressed. Wondering what to do, he walked across the landing to the tiny window and looked out. There was a school across the road. A class of girls played netball in the playground. From where he was, Kevin couldn't tell whether they were old enough for him to lust after. He went back to Fitzpeterson's door and leaned on the bell. The noise of the elevator arriving startled him. If it was a neighbour, maybe he could ask. The sight of a tall young policeman emerging from the elevator shocked him. He felt guilty. But, to his surprise, the constable saluted him. You must be the gentleman's brother, the policeman said. Kevin thought fast. Who told you that, he said. The porter. Kevin came at him fast with another question. And why are you here? Just checking he's all right. He didn't turn up for a meeting this morning. And his phone's off the hook. They ought to have bodyguards, you know, but they won't, these ministers. He looked at the door. No answer? No. Any reason you know of, he might have been, well, ill, upset, called away? Kevin said, well, he rang me up this morning and sounded distressed. That's why I came. It was a very dangerous game he was playing, he knew. But he had not lied yet, and anyway, it was too late to back out. The policeman said, perhaps we should get the key from the porter. Kevin didn't want that. He said, I wonder if we should break the door down. My God, if he's ill in there. The policeman was young and inexperienced, and the prospect of breaking a door down seemed to appeal to him. He said, it could be as bad as that, you think? Who knows? For the sake of a door, the Fitzpiersons are not a poor family. No, sir. He needed no more encouragement. He put his shoulder to the door experimentally. One good shove. Kevin stood close to him, and the two men hit the door simultaneously. They made more noise than impact. Kevin said, it's not like this in the movies. Then bit his tongue. The remark was inappropriately flippant. The policeman seemed not to notice. He said, once more. This time, they both put all their weight into it. The doorpost splintered, and the female half of the lock came free, falling to the floor as the door flew open. Kevin let the policeman go in first. As he followed him into the hall, the man said, no smell of gas. All electric flats, Kevin said, guessing. There were three doors off the tiny hall. The first led into a small bathroom, where Kevin glimpsed a row of toothbrushes and a full-length mirror. The second stood open, revealing a kitchen which looked as if it might have been searched recently. They went through the third door and saw Fitzperson immediately. He sat in an upright chair at his desk, his head in his arms, as if he'd fallen asleep over his work. But there was no work on his desk. Just the phone, a glass, and an empty bottle. The bottle was small and made of brown glass, with a white cap and a white label bearing handwriting, the kind of bottle chemists use to dispense sleeping pills. For all his youth, the policeman acted commendably fast. He said, Mr. Fitzpiersons, sir, very loudly, and without pause crossed the room and thrust his hand inside the dressing gown to feel the prone man's heart. Kevin stood very still for a moment. At last the policeman said, still alive. The young constable seemed to take command. He waved Kevin toward Fitzpiersons. Talk to him, he said. Then he took a radio from his breast pocket and spoke into it. Kevin took the politician's shoulder. The body felt curiously dead under the dressing gown. Wake up! Wake up, he said. The policeman finished on the radio and joined him. Ambulance any minute, he said. Let's walk him. They took an arm each and tried to make the unconscious man walk. Kevin said, is this what you're supposed to do? I bloody well hope so. Well, I wish I'd paid attention at my first aid classes. You and me both. Kevin was itching to get to a phone. He could see the headline, I Save Minister's Life. He was not a callous young man, but he had long known that the story which made his name would probably be a tragedy for someone else. Now that it had happened, he wanted to use it before it slipped through his fingers. He wished the ambulance would hurry. There was no reaction from Fitzpiersons to the walking treatment. The policeman said, talk to him. Tell him who you are. This was getting a bit near the bone. Kevin swallowed hard and said, Tim! Tim, it's me! Tell him your name. Kevin was saved by an ambulance in the street. He shouted over the noise of the siren, let's get him onto the landing, ready! They dragged the limp body out through the door. As they waited by the elevator, the policeman felt Fitzpiersons's heart again. Struth, I can't feel nothing, he said. The elevator arrived and two ambulance men emerged. The elder took a quick look and said, overdose? Yes, the policeman said. No stretcher then, Bill. Keep him standing. The policeman said to Kevin, do you want to go with him? It was the last thing Kevin wanted to do. I should stay here and use the phone, he said. The ambulance men were in the elevator supporting Fitzpiersons between them. We're off, the elder said, and pressed the button. The policeman got out his radio again, and Kevin went back into the flat. The phone was on the desk, but he didn't want the copper listening in. Maybe there was an extension in the bedroom. He went through.
There was a grey trim phone on a little chipboard bedside unit. He dialed the post. Coffee, please. Kevin Hart here. Government Minister Tim Fitzpeterson was rushed to hospital today after attempting to commit suicide. Point paragraph. I discovered the comatose body of the Energy Ministry's oil supremo after he had told me, comma, in a hysterical phone call, comma, that he was being blackmailed. Point par. The minister... Kevin tailed off. You still there? The copy taker demanded. Kevin was silent. He'd just noticed the blood on the crumpled sheets beside him. And he felt ill. Chapter 17. What do I get out of my work? Derek Hamilton had been asking himself this question all morning, while the drugs wore off and the pain of his ulcer became sharper and more frequent. Like the pain, the question surfaced at moments of stress. Hamilton had begun badly in a meeting with a finance director who had proposed a schedule of expenditure cuts amounting to a 50% shutdown of the entire operation. The plan was no good. It would have helped cash flow and destroyed profitability, but Hamilton could see no alternatives and the dilemma had made him angry. He'd yelled at the accountant, "I ask you for solutions and you tell me to close up the bloody shop." Such behaviour towards senior management was quite intolerable, he knew. The man would certainly resign and might not be dissuaded. Then his secretary, an elegant, unflappable married woman who spoke three languages, had bothered him with a list of trivia, and he'd shouted at her too. Being what she was, she probably thought it part of her job to take that kind of maltreatment, but that was no excuse, he thought. And each time he cursed himself and his staff and his ulcer, he found himself wondering, what am I doing here? He ran over possible answers as the car took him the short distance between his office and Nathaniel Fett's. Money, as an incentive, could not be dismissed quite as easily as he sometimes pretended. It was true that he and Ellen could live comfortably on his capital, or even the interest on his capital. But his dreams went beyond a comfortable life. Real success in business would mean a £1 million yacht and a villa in Cannes and a grouse swarm of his own, and the chance to buy the Picassos he liked instead of just looking at reproductions in glossy books. Such were his dreams, or such they had been. It was now probably too late. Hamilton Holdings would not make sensational profits in his lifetime. As a young man, he'd wanted power and prestige, he supposed. In that, he'd failed. There was no prestige in being chairman of an ailing company, no matter how big, and his power was rendered worthless by the strictures of the accountants. He was not sure what people meant when they talked about job satisfaction. It was an odd expression, calling to mind a picture of a craftsman making a table from a piece of wood, or a farmer leading a herd of plump lambs to market. Business was not like that. Even if one were moderately successful, there would always be new frustrations. And for Hamilton, there was nothing other than business. Even if he'd wanted to, he had not the ability to make tables or breed sheep, write textbooks or design office blocks. He thought again about his sons. Ellen had been right. Neither of them was counting on the inheritance. If asked for their counsel, they would certainly say, "It's yours, spend it." Nevertheless, it went against his instincts to dispose of the business which had made his family rich. Perhaps he thought I should disobey my instinct. Following it has not made me happy. For the first time, he wondered what he would do if he did not have to go to the office. He had no interest in village life. Walking to the pub with a dog on a lead like his neighbour Colonel Quinton would bore Hamilton. Newspapers would hold no interest. He only read the business pages now, and if he had no business, even they would be dull. He was fond of his garden, but he couldn't see himself spending all day digging weeds and forking in fertiliser. What were the things we used to do when we were young? It seemed, in retrospect, that Ellen and he had spent an awful lot of time doing absolutely nothing. They'd gone for long drives in his two-seater, sometimes meeting friends for a picnic. Why? Why get in a car, go a long way, eat sandwiches and come back?
They'd gone to shows and to restaurants, but that was in the evening. Yet there had always seemed to be too few free days for them to spend together. Well, it might be time for him and Ellen to start rediscovering each other, and £1 million would buy some of his dreams. They could have a villa. Perhaps not in Cannes, but somewhere in the Sud. He could buy a yacht, big enough for the Mediterranean and small enough for him to drive himself. The Grouse-Moor was out of the question, but there might be enough left for one or two decent paintings. This Lasky fellow was buying a headache. However, headaches seemed to be his speciality. Hamilton knew a little about him. The man had no background, no education, no family, but he had brains and cash, and in hard times those things counted for more than good breeding. Perhaps Lasky and Hamilton Holdings deserved each other. It was an odd thing Hamilton had said to Nathaniel Fett. Tell Lasky that if I sell him my company by midday, I want the money in my hand by noon. How eccentric. To ask for cash on the nail like the proprietor of a Glasgow liquor store. But he knew why he'd done it. The effect had been to take the decision out of his hands. If Lasky could produce the money, the deal would be done. If not, not. Incapable of making up his mind, Hamilton had tossed a halfpenny. Suddenly he hoped fervently that Lasky would be able to raise the cash. Derek Hamilton wanted never to go back to the office. The car drew up outside Fett's place and he got out. Chapter 18. The beauty of being an earwig, Bertie Cheeseman had found, was that you could do almost anything while you were listening to the police radio. And the tragedy of it, from his point of view, was that there was nothing much he wanted to do. Already this morning he'd swept the carpet, a process of raising dust only for it to fall again soon afterward, while the airwaves were filled with uninteresting messages about traffic in the Old Kent Road. He had also shaved at the sink in the corner, using a safety razor and hot water from the Ascot, and fried a single rasher of bacon on the cooker in the same room for his breakfast. He ate very little. He'd called the Evening Post only once since his first report at 8 o'clock, to tip them off about an ambulance call to a block of flats in Westminster. The name of the patient had not been mentioned over the air, but Bertie had surmised from the address that it might just possibly be someone important. It was up to the news desk to phone ambulance headquarters and ask the name, and if headquarters had been told, they would pass the information on. Often the ambulance men didn't make their report until the patient was in the hospital. Bertie occasionally talked to reporters, and he always asked them questions about how they used the information he gave them and turned them into stories. He was quite well informed about the mechanics of journalism. Apart from that and the traffic, there had been only shoplifting, petty vandalism, a couple of accidents, a small demonstration in Downing Street, and one mystery. The mystery was in East London, but that was about all Bertie knew. He had heard an all-cars alert, but the subsequent message had been uninformative. The cars were asked to look out for a plain blue van with a certain registration number. It might simply have been hijacked with a cargo of cigarettes, or it might be driven by someone the police wanted to question, or it might have been in a robbery. The word Obadiah had been used, but he didn't know why. Immediately after the alert, three cars had been detached from regular patrol to search for the van. That meant very little. The fuss might be over nothing at all. Perhaps even some flying squad inspector's runaway wife. Bertie had known it to happen. On the other hand, it could be big. He was waiting for more information. The landlady came up while he was cleaning his frying pan with warm water and a rag. He dried his hands on his sweater and got out the rent book. Mrs. Keeney, in an apron and curlers, stared in awe at the radio equipment, although she saw it every week. Bertie gave her the money and she signed the book. Then she handed him a letter. "I don't know why you don't have some nice music on," she said. He smiled. He hadn't told her what he used the radio for, as it was against the law to listen to police radio.
"I'm not very musical," he said. She shook her head resignedly and went out. Bertie opened the letter. It was his monthly cheque from the Evening Post. He'd had a good spell. The cheque was for £500. Bertie paid no tax. He found it difficult to spend all his money. The job compelled him to live fairly simply. He spent every evening in pubs, and on Sundays he went out in the car, his one luxury, a bright new Ford Capri. He went to all sorts of places, like a tourist. He had been to Canterbury Cathedral, Windsor Castle, Bewley, St. Albans, Bath, Oxford. He visited safari parks, stately homes, ancient monuments, historic towns, racetracks and funfairs with equal enjoyment. He had never had so much money in his life. There was enough to buy everything he wanted and a little left over to save. He put the cheque in a drawer and finished cleaning the frying pan. As he was putting it away, the radio crackled and a sixth sense told him to listen carefully. "That's right. Blue Bedford six-wheeler, Alpha Charlie, London 203 Mother. Has it what? Distinguishing marks? Yes. If you look inside, you'll notice it has a most unusual feature. Six large boxes of used notes." Bertie frowned. The radio operator at headquarters was being funny, obviously, but what he said implied that the missing van was carrying a large sum of money. That sort of van did not go missing accidentally. It must have been hijacked. Bertie sat down at his table and picked up the phone. Chapter 19. Felix Lasky and Nathaniel Fett stood up when Derek Hamilton entered the room. Lasky, the would-be buyer, and Hamilton, the vendor, shook hands briefly, like boxers before a fight. Lasky realized with a shock that he and Hamilton were wearing identical suits, dark blue with a pinstripe. They even had the same six-button, double-breasted jacket without vents. But Hamilton's gross body took away any elegance the style had. On him, the most beautiful suit would look like a length of cloth wrapped around a jelly. Lasky knew, without looking in a mirror, that his own suit appeared to be much more expensive. He told himself not to feel superior. The wrong attitude could ruin a negotiation. He said, "Nice to see you again, Hamilton." Hamilton nodded. "How do you do, Mr. Lasky?" The chair squeaked as he sat down. The use of Mr. did not escape Lasky. Hamilton would only employ the unadorned surname with his equals. Lasky crossed his legs and waited for Fett, the broker, to open the proceedings. He studied Hamilton out of the corner of his eye. The man might have been handsome in his youth, he decided. He had a high forehead, a straight nose, and bright blue eyes. Right now he looked relaxed, with his hands folded in his lap. Lasky thought he'd made up his mind already. Fett said, "For the record, Derek owns 510,000 shares in Hamilton Holdings Limited, a public company. Another 490,000 are owned by various parties, and there are no unissued shares. Mr. Lasky, you offer to buy those 510,000 shares for the sum of £1,000,000 on condition the deed of sale is dated today and signed at 12 noon, or that a letter to that intent is so dated and signed." "Quite so." Lasky tuned out as Fett continued to enunciate formalities in a dry monotone. He was thinking that Hamilton probably deserved to lose his wife. A woman as vivacious and highly sexed as Ellen was entitled to a full-blooded love life. Her husband had no right to let himself run to seed. "Here I am," he thought, "stealing the man's wife and taking away his life's work. And still he can make me squirm by calling me Mister." "As I see it," Fett was concluding, "the deal can be done just as Mr. Lasky has outlined it. The documents are satisfactory. There remains only the larger question of whether and under what conditions Derek will sell." He sat back,
with the air of one who has completed a ritual. Hamilton looked at Lasky. "What are your plans for the group?" he asked. Lasky suppressed a sigh. There was no point to any kind of cross-examination. He was quite free to tell Hamilton a pack of lies. He did just that. "The first step would be a large capital injection," he said. "Then an improvement in management services, a shakeout at top level in the operating companies, and some streamlining in low-performance sectors." Nothing could have been farther from the truth. But if Hamilton wanted to read the script from the top, Lasky was happy to go along with it. "You've chosen a crucial moment at which to make your offer." "Not really," Lasky said. "The oil well, if it happens, will be a bonus. What I'm buying is a fundamentally sound group, which is going through a bad patch. I shall make it profitable without meddling with its infrastructure. That happens to be my particular talent." He smiled self-consciously. "Despite my reputation, I'm interested in running real industries, not trading in equities." He caught a hostile glance from Fett. The broker knew he was lying. "So, why the 12 o'clock deadline?"
"I think the price of Hamilton shares will go up unreasonably if you get the license. This could be my last chance for some time of buying at a sensible price."
"Fair enough," Hamilton said, taking the initiative away from Fett. "But I too have set a deadline. How do you feel about that?"
"Quite happy," Lasky lied.
In truth, he was desperately worried. Hamilton's wish to see the money in his hand at the time the deal was signed was unexpected. Lasky had planned to pay a deposit today and the balance when final contracts were exchanged. But although Hamilton's stipulation was eccentric, it was perfectly reasonable. Once the letter had been signed, Lasky was able to trade in the shares, either selling them or using them to raise a loan. What he planned was to use the shares at their oil-inflated price to raise the money to pay for the original purchase. But he had fallen into the pit he had dug. He had tempted Hamilton with a fast deal, and the old man had gone for it too well. Lasky didn't know what he was going to do, for he did not have £1 million. He would have been scraping the barrel for the 100,000 deposit. But he did know what he was not going to do. He was not going to let this deal slip through his fingers.
"Quite happy," he repeated.
Fett said,
"Derek, perhaps now is the time you and I should have a few minutes together."
"I don't think so," Hamilton interrupted, "unless you plan to tell me that this deal is riddled with pitfalls."
"Not at all."
"In that case," Hamilton turned to Lasky, "I accept." Lasky stood up and shook Hamilton's hand. The fat man was mildly embarrassed by the gesture, but it was one Lasky believed in. Men like Hamilton could always find escape clauses in a contract, but they could not bear to renege on a handshake. Lasky said, "The funds are in the Cotton Bank of Jamaica, London branch, of course. I imagine this presents no problem." He drew a checkbook from his pocket. Fett frowned. It was a very small bank, but perfectly respectable. He would have preferred a check drawn on a clearing bank, but he could hardly object at this stage without seeming obstructive. Lasky knew he would feel like this. Lasky wrote the check and handed it to Hamilton.
"It's not often a man pockets £1 million, he said.
Hamilton seemed to become jovial. He smiled. "It's not often a man spends it," Lasky said. "When I was 10 years old, our rooster died, and I went with my father to market to buy a new one. It cost the equivalent of £3. But my family had saved for a year to accumulate that money. More heart-searching went into the purchase of that rooster than any financial deal I have ever done, this one included." He smiled, knowing they were uneasy to hear this story and not caring. "£1 million is nothing."